てる
んですよ。Oh, she's closing the door. Tell her we can't start without a quorum. We need a quorum. When she's done.I hate to interrupt the hallway conversation.
She may be glad to be interrupted. I have had some that I would have been happy.
Exactly.
To
please.
Mm-hmm. That's
and now we don't have a staff.
He hit the gas.
Sometimes you can't win.
I know. I didn't know.
All right, now we have a quorum and a co-pilot. Are you ready? Okay. We'll call the House Revenue meeting to order. Welcome everybody here this morning. We've got several bills up on work session. We will not be taking up House Bill 2184. I'd put that on the schedule a couple of weeks ago thinking that this might be it might be timely. I think it's not yet, so we will not be taking up 2184. So let's begin with House Bill 2298. Commissioner Milne, I guess you have a commission meeting to get to. So
3134.
I'm sorry, that's the one I meant. We'll start with 3134 and open a work session on House Bill 3134. And then welcome back, Commissioner Milne. Paul, do you want to bring us up today on this?
Mr. Chair, you have amendments to 3134. This is the bill that allows counties to establish a tax lien certificate program. And the Dash 2 amendments go through and deal with some of the issues that were really raised by Department of Revenue to try to put some flesh on that rather skeletal bill you had initially. And what it does is several things. It makes it clear that it is a local option requiring the county governing body by ordinance to authorize the program. It does makes it clear the Department of Revenue must approve how the program is set up without being explicit exactly what the rules are. The intent here is to establish to give the counties flexibility to set up this program, yet have the Department of Revenue have retain an oversight role. As in the original bill, the tax liens cannot be sold unless property is has more than a year past due property tax. The sale of the tax lien is not subject to any limitation. ORS 311.785 states the county cannot compromise taxes. An investor purchasing the tax lien is to receive the taxes, penalties, and interest. That's also in the original bill. There is a change in the foreclosure process to refer to the personal foreclosure process, which is Chapter 88 in lieu of ORS Chapter 312. I talked with counsel about this, is a little bit less cumbersome process and really should make it more workable. The department maintains general supervision of the foreclosure process as well. The one area that we do feel is, and also talking with Commissioner Milne on this, that probably needs a little bit more work is on the proceeds. Under the amendment, the proceeds of the sale of the tax lien go into the unsegregated tax collections account. What is left open is how that might impact the statewide CAFA account. Remember, that's redistributed back to the counties.
CAFA being?
CAFA is the, help me, John, on that.
County Assessment Functions Funding Account. Okay.
So that's the account in which the delinquent interest is one of the components to, along with the document fees. And then the department goes through and establishes a distribution formula for each of the counties based on a series of factors. We have an additional amendment that we've asked Dexter to begin drafting that would state that the Department of Revenue should take this program into account when allocating that distribution from that account back to the individual county. So without specifying a specific percentage, they should take that into account. And that's an amendment that's not here but is in the works right now. The final point here on this amendment is that It does limit the property liens involved to real property only, and that's on the Section 1, Subsection 6 there, the liens arising from property taxes imposed on real property.
Mm-hmm. All right. Commissioner Milne, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have you had a chance to look at these? It sounds like you've talked with Paul.
Yes, and Paul has been very helpful, and I think he's explained those amendments quite accurately. And
could you? I'm sorry, Penny. Can you bring that microphone closer to you? There, thank you.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Is that good?
That's very well done.
Mr. Chair, I would like to just take a moment to address a couple of issues to bring a little clarity that may hopefully will respond to some of the issues that have arisen since we were here previously, and excuse me, perhaps that will help, and it will also perhaps help explain these amendments a little bit. The first, and not necessarily in order of importance, but one of the issues, excuse me.
Do some water.
Sure, that would be great. Thank you. One of the issues that, of course, is of concern is what happens to the 16% interest that the counties currently rely so heavily on. And, yes, it's a very small piece of county funding because, as we all know, as everyone has very clearly, thank you so much, clearly expressed that Oregonians really are very good at paying their taxes, and we do have very few people who become delinquent. So this money, although it's a small portion of money, is relied on, such as, you know, our assessors and tax folks. However, it is not our intent in any way, shape, or form to adversely affect our counties. I mean, obviously, I'm a county commissioner. I'm here to try to maximize the monies in our county general fund. I have every intention of protecting the monies that our counties get from these various funds, whether it's the tax monies themselves, this money that goes back to the Department of Revenue, and then we beg and plead to get some of it back. I understand the anxiety that some folks are having over a potential loss of this money. There will be no loss. If you are receiving the tax on time, like 90-some percent of the people are doing, you don't have the 16% interest that you need to rely on. If you get 100%, you don't have to wait 5 years and hope to get 16 on what's not been collected. This 16% is on money that's missing from our general fund. And it's this missing money that we're here to put back into the general fund. So what one of these amendments we're talking about is because I do understand that concern, the anxiety. This is the way it's been done for years and years, and the process is so frustrating. I understand that they don't want to lose anything, and we don't want that to happen either. That's why we're trying to figure out, and I'm looking to the Department of Revenue. I trust they've already got a formula in place of how monies are distributed. We can work on a formula and provide, for lack of a better way of saying it, some floor. You know, there's a minimum level based on history for the counties that should there be no purchase of a tax lien in any county, yes, you're going to continue to get that 16%. Absolutely, that is our intent. There would be no loss.
So the concern then is that if you've got some counties that participate in this and some don't, there will be less money going into the CAFA account from this interest earnings, and so because of that, that's going to reduce the distributions. I mean, and without some adjustment, that would reduce the distributions statewide, so counties who aren't participating in the CAFA program would see a reduction in their funding under the CAFA. And what you're saying is we can accommodate that in the distribution formula. so that the reduction would be borne, to the extent there's a reduction borne by the counties that are participating in the CAFA or in the lien sale program, but then the benefit, the trade-off to them is they're getting their taxes paid up front, and everybody else is held harmless.
Yes.
Is that the intent of the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, exactly. If a county does choose to participate and they sell some tax liens, well, clearly, then they don't need to rely on the grant, or maybe they don't need to rely on it quite as much. So we could put together, create a formula that provides balance until such time that the program is really up to speed. But I think, too, to keep in mind that, so what you're saying is, yes, there, the fear is there'd be less money going into the grant, so I may get less back because there are fewer dollars in the pot. But what you have to keep in mind, again, if maybe to look at it from the standpoint of currently, let me just use 95% because it's a round figure. We collect 95% of the taxes now on time. So we're only talking about 5%. Well, what if we were collecting 98% of the taxes or 99% of the taxes? There's going to be fewer dollars going to the Department of Revenue because you need fewer. And but again, our point here that we really want to make, and we are leaving it to the experts to figure that out, is let's protect, make sure that if there are no lien sales, the current program stays in place, the counties can depend on that money. If there are lien sales, then you balance. Okay. You balance that. And then if I could just touch on, along with that, there are, as was discussed, there are also recording fees that go into this. Those would not be affected at all. We're not looking to touch those at all. And then the final thing is, with regard to foreclosure, I think there's been some confusion, and again, our counties, you know, we're sensitive, caring people as elected officials and appointed people in the county. And no, nobody wants to see a foreclosure happen. These are horrible situations. And as we've learned, that happens very, very seldom. There's been a concern, however, of, well, gee, you know, can the county be more sensitive than a private investor? And there were some stories shared with me about how counties can make deals with delinquent property owners. Now, I'm not an attorney, as I know you are, Mr. Chair, but I did ask our county council, in fact, to review with me the process because I wanted to be sure that I understand it. The property, current Oregon law, properties are 3 years delinquent, and then the county is required by state law. Statute says that the county has to file legal action. This takes roughly a year to go through the process to complete it. The county has the title, but the property owner is still in possession of the property. And we're talking now about this two-year redemption period. This is the opportunity for the property owner to pay in full. If after that time, and it's a set time, there's no flexibility, the county can't say, well, we're going to give you six more months. That's according to law, as I understand it. That's not the case. But the person does have the opportunity in that redemption to pay in full and be back in full position. However, if that doesn't happen within this time, yes, the county takes possession. Now, what we've proposed here is no different. There would be no difference to the property owner. The only difference is, rather than the county pursuing the foreclosure process, it's the responsibility of the investor. In fact, that provides more flexibility, because what if the investor says, well, I'm not going to pursue the foreclosure process? And now we can put into our law whatever we want, that you're mandated to pursue, or yes, the investor has flexibility. But according to other states, there is that flexibility. I'm not saying we have to do it exactly as such. But the point is, there is the exact same protection with what we are proposing as current law. The property owner is protected exactly the same. There is no greater risk to that property owner, and in fact, there could be more flexibility. So I wanted to clarify that because there is a fear of what will happen to the property owners, and there is no risk.
All right.
Thank you
very much. Do we have questions for Chanel? Mr. Balkima, welcome back, and I see we've got your materials here. I don't know, we're not in public hearing, so we don't need to hear a lot of testimony. Do you have more to say about the amendments in particular? I want to bring the Department of Revenue up and talk about those for a second.
Yeah, real quickly, we'll skip over some of the stuff, like the first two pages. Now, you're going to, on the third page, you should have a copy of just some figures to the Mr. Chair that most of the committee would not understand what it is. But what it is, it's a redemption of a certificate that I had where the people came in and paid it up. And the second page of that where you see the word redeemed marked on it, that's from my personal records. But it does show that the people paid their taxes in 98, quit paying them in 99. That's when, and I stepped in and bought all the taxes from 99, 2000, 2001. And then, miraculously, they came up with the money, they redeemed it. And if you look at the third page of this example, it shows that all the taxes are paid except the last half of 2002, which is for them is not delinquent yet. So the record really doesn't affect the landowner as to how their taxes deal with them in particular. And then when you go to the next example I have here, it's called the Pinal County Treasurer Tax Receipt. There's been some issues about having to issue certificates, have to filing in county recorder's office and all this. Well, the county I deal with in Arizona, they have everything on computer. And when you, or myself as an investor, goes in and I pay up all the taxes that are delinquent on this particular property, you will notice that the original taxes went delinquent in 1990, and somebody put a certificate on it, another investor put a certificate on it, up to 93. Well, at that point, that investor either said, whoa, I want my money back, or for whatever reason chose not to foreclose on the property, which benefits the landowner. And then on the 94, I stepped in and bought out the other certificate owner, and I paid up all the taxes clear to the year 2001 again. And if you'll also notice on there, you'll hear from our opposition about this bill that they don't get any monies and they're going to lose their grant from the government. Well, if you'll notice on this exhibit that I have, in 1990, the first figure you see is interest and fees, $370.13. The 1990 cert, which is the taxes for the property for that year. All those I paid when I redeemed this thing for a total of over $4,000. So the county's got that interest, got that fees up front when I bought the certificate. And so they did not lose a dime. Now, from when I bought the certificate forward, yes, I'll be getting the 16% interest. And if the landowner pays up, yes, I will be getting all these interests and fees and all that back that I have already paid the county, which is what I should be put back in the same place I was before I ever put my money in there. So the counties will still get their interest or fees. They're just getting it from a third party, an investor, and they get it now instead of 5-6 years down the road. So I wanted to show some examples that this really does still benefit the counties. They're not going to lose all the money that they're claiming they're going to lose. And it may reduce, like Commissioner Milne said, your bigger counties like Marion County, Washington County, McNomah. Yeah, if they collect more taxes that's owed to them, then I would say, yeah, proportionate. They should balance down the amount of that grant they get. And then counties like Maurer County over in Eastern Oregon and stuff, or Jefferson County, then, yeah, they should keep the amount of money that they're already accumulating.
Okay, Mr. Balkema, I want to hear from the Department of Revenue on
that. Thank you.
Ms. Balkema, color commentary. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, John Phillips. Especially since we hear there are going to be some more amendments coming. They'll just be. But I want to hear from John what you've worked up on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. Hi. At the last committee meeting, you and Representative Williams asked for some modeling, and I did some relative to that CAFA fund, that County Assessment and Taxation Fund, and I'm having that passed out now. That may become a non-issue if there's an amendment for Friday that deals with a way to back out that money, as we've discussed. So to the extent you want me to talk about that, I'd be happy to do
that. No, I think let's anticipate that that's going to be that we'll do that, because I think that's a reasonable amendment to balance out the distribution for CAFA fund.
Would you like me to address comments to the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes, please.
Okay. The Dash 2 amendments I just saw this morning provide some additional information. As we've discussed in the past, the bill is very, very doesn't really say much. It just says that we can do this. And so a lot of questions came to our mind about what the rules should be, whether additional statutory requirements would be necessary. And this does provide a little more flesh to the bill. It talks about the county actually making an affirmative decision via a resolution or ordinance. It talks about the program before it's launched having a sort of a review by the department. We'll take a very proactive role in reviewing the plan before it's actually implemented in the county. That's the way I would interpret this. So it gives us a chance to think through the steps and to see how the county's thought through the steps, too, to make sure that it's all the way brought to a conclusion. It does talk about in Section 1, Number 2, about the lien being in existence for 1 year. In Sub 3, it talks about the not limited to any provisions for canceling taxes. And this was our concern because it sounds like there were some other states that allow either taxes to be canceled or interest to be bid down, and we weren't sure what that meant. So then on lines 21 and 22, the first page talks about a different foreclosure process. Frankly, on the property tax side, we don't have a lot of experience. I could not tell you what that process is. Probably on our income or corporate side, there's a familiarity with the foreclosure process, and so we would have to do some more research on this, but it appears to be a process that's established in statute for other kinds of real property foreclosure. So, and finally, on the second page,
I guess this chapter 312 is the county foreclosure, and it'd be hard to plug an individual into that. Chapter 88, that's right, would be your
correct
mortgage and trust deed foreclosure, I think, statutes.
Correct, Mr. Chair. We discussed how to change Chapter 312 to sort of, add wording to say, and the district attorney or an investor's attorney, and every time there was a reference to the county doing something or the district attorney doing something, then we would have to insert other language. So this was
Tchaikovsky, Romeo and Juliet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Much more interesting to listen to, Mr. Chair. So I think this deals with the issues of trying to fold in an investor's steps in that process.
Okay. Well, John, I appreciate that. And if we can, between now and Friday, have you continue to work with Paul and with Commissioner Milne.
Sure.
You can get her telephone number. And we'll take a look at these, I guess, again on Friday. I think the sense of the committee when we heard this last time was interest at least, but concern to make sure that the department had looked at this and that it was technically workable and that we didn't create new problems going forward with this. And it sounds to me like we're at least making progress toward that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Does anybody else just absolutely have to be heard on this today, knowing there are still amendments in the work? Diane, you're here. All right. Bring your friend. That's all right. They're coming out of the woodwork.
Lots of friends.
Oh, Harry, you're coming too. Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Belt. I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I appreciate the opportunity to come back and bring a little more information. Since our last hearing, speaking with the sponsors of the bill, it's my understanding that they were trying to pattern this more after the Arizona process. So last week I've been on the phone to treasurers in Arizona and on the Internet, and I can tell you everything about a certificate of delinquency in Arizona. So what I wanted to do was try to model that to the way our process works and try to come up with some numbers to see how that would come together. And I think that we need to understand that there's a couple of main differences. Number one, Arizona does not offer a 3% discount, and we do. Number two, the counties receive all of the delinquent interest that is collected. So any interest that's collected goes to the county, and they also assess a 5% penalty, which we don't have. Mm-hmm. They conduct a sale after 2 years. The counties that I spoke with, or the one in particular, Maricopa County, they seem to be fairly similar with Washington County in size and numbers. So what I did is I looked at their sale, which they had detailed information on the Internet about, and their 2001 tax year, they advertised 28,000 accounts. Washington County would have had 2,600. The value of those accounts was 27 million. Ours is 4.5. They don't auction off, or they have to advertise, but they can't auction any properties that would be in litigation, like bankruptcy or things like that. So, kind of using their percentage, we would have had about 670. They typically sell about 60% of their liens. Some counties, like Mojave County, they advertised 23,000. They sold 1,500. So probably Washington County would have sold about 1,300 tax liens, and that would have resulted in a tax collection of about $2.9 million. Looking at our state report, consistently Washington County collects between $2 to $2.5 million worth of delinquent interest every year. Taxing district shares approximately 12%. The county also receives about $1.5 million from the CAFA fund. So when I take the amount that would have been generated from the sale and run it through our distribution schedule, the county would have received about $427,000 additional. But the downside is we probably would have lost quite a bit of the delinquent interest, which our A&T grant is about $1.5 million.
But if Diane, if we work this out, so the formula takes into account participating and non-participating counties in the Department of Revenue's grant, does that help?
Mr. Chair, I don't think so, because we're not getting that delinquent interest, period. I mean, because we share also in the delinquent interest that we collect, not just the CAFA fund. I mean, the $2.5 million that we collect consistently, a share of that also comes to the county. So that goes away as well.
It sounds like one of the big credit card companies that depends on at least a certain percentage of people not paying off their credit cards in order to be profitable.
Yeah, you know, Mr. Chair, it's interesting because we have so many people call that want to pay with a credit card to take advantage of the 3% discount, but yet they're willing to pay 23% on their credit card to get the 3%. But anyway, those were my comments,
okay,
and
thanks.
I'll let the other two throw their two cents in. Go ahead, Bob.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Bob Vrome, and I'm the Assessment and Tax Manager for Clackamas County. And if you'll bear with me, because I'm trying to lose my voice, so I'll be as brief as possible. I'm going to reserve my comments to some very specific points. And the first, and what we think is very important, is that potential loss of delinquent interest revenue to counties. And additionally, the grant program that provides that assessment and taxation funding to all 36 assessment and taxation offices in the counties. There is talk of amendments, and I tend to agree with Diane. I understand what the amendments were seemingly being aimed at, but if we're not collecting the interest, there's no point in redistribution. And the other thing that I think is worth noting is that even though additional tax revenue might be collected up front as opposed through the delinquent interest process, in light of the funding issues that everyone's dealing with today, there's no guarantee that there will be additional funding to A&T functions. And that's what the CAFA program was designed and actually sweated over and worked very hard for by not only the legislature, but the League of Oregon Cities and AOC and special districts and any number of organizations to come up with that program that would provide adequate funding for the A&T function. Additionally, taxing districts will lose some of that delinquent interest. And in Oregon, as you well know, property owners are provided the opportunity to pay up front and in full and receive a 3% discount. Delinquent interest that's collected down the road for property that taxes that aren't collected actually offsets some of that revenue that's lost as a result of being able to provide those discounts. It also offsets interest payments that are made when taxing districts or when we have to refund as a result of corrections, for instance, where we pay 12%. So again, delinquent interest is actually offsetting some of that lost revenue because we never collect 100% of that tax roll. And so when you look at that, we are currently collecting about 95 or 96% in the first year, I think that that's a fairly extraordinary collection record. Also, if you look at the end of the process, we foreclose on very few properties. Clackamas County, since 1990, has foreclosed on an average of about 23 to 26 properties a year. So we're collecting those taxes and we're collecting that delinquent interest with the process that we currently have now, and we're collecting the bulk of those monies up front. finally, again, taxpayers are going to see some impact from this bill. They're going to lose some payment flexibility, and they may incur some additional costs as a result of being able or a process that allows the sale of tax certificate liens. For instance, when that lien is sold after the first year, if that taxpayer should choose to redeem, he's going to have to pay in full all of the taxes, all of the delinquent interest, and any penalties. With our process now, we accept partial payments, so people that are making payments all along may not be able to avail themselves of that after a tax lien sale has taken place. Again, and I think from the testimony that you've heard before this, we're going to incur some additional costs as well. This program isn't going to fund itself. We're looking at some additional programming costs probably to be able to handle and provide for this process. We may need some additional staffing at A&T offices. There's going to be the requirement, I'm sure, to maintain accounting records and possibly maintain Social Security numbers on investors, W-9 forms, issue 1099 forms for interest income. That process isn't going to take place without some cost. We'll also have certainly some additional customer service responsibility. We're going to have to explain this process not only to taxpayers, but certainly there will be inquiry from investors.
If your county adopts it.
If your county adopts it.
If your county adopts it. Yeah. Nothing that we're doing, that would be if your county adopts it.
Chair Shetterly, that's true. I guess my only comment to that, and that's it. That's a matter of public policy that the legislature would decide whether or not that, you know, this should be a permissive thing. I would only comment that currently, if you look at most of our processes within our property tax administration program, they're very consistent throughout the state. Our foreclosure process is consistent. Our tax payment processes are consistent. This would be a significantly different process that might vary from county to county if it were so available. Finally, I think our system already contains a relatively adequate degree of incentive for taxpayers to pay timely. We allow a discount. There certainly is a delinquent interest rate of 16% for property taxpayers that don't pay timely. And I guess we just question the need for this program in light of the current collection history and the possibility of starting a new program that may provide for additional cost to the counties. Thank you, and I'll be happy to try and answer any questions.
Okay, let's go next.
Thank you, Chair Lee, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bartholomew, representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors and employed at Multnomah County. I'll just try to be real brief. I haven't had much time to really look at this process that closely, and I'm not really here to speak for or against the bill. Just a couple of things that might concern me or that I think might be considered. First of all, why would this process want to be adopted? And I think that it's for the benefit of counties. But I haven't seen any county governing bodies here yet on behalf of this bill. Maybe they just haven't been educated yet. But from my perspective, from the tax collector side, we're not really, you know, to say yay or nay. Our position would be, you know, if our county governing body wants to do this, how can it be done right? What's the right way to do it? That leads me into the laws. Even with the amendments, there's not very many statutes here. And I did just hop on the Internet real quick and look at the Arizona. They've got several chapters on tax lien sales, many, many, many statutes. So I wonder if you're really covering everything. And the other thing you'll want to consider is whether citizens will be treated in the same manner. And I'm not sure on all of that, but I think the foreclosure process sounds like it might be different, that different people might be treated in a different manner regarding their delinquencies. One example, I understood in the Arizona system that they can only make one payment to pay off the balance. In Oregon, you can make partial payments as long as they're at least $40. So I don't know, would that change, and or should that change? And as Bob mentioned, the administrative costs, if there are things that we will need to do, then we'd be concerned about funding for those. And the implementation of the process, I think the programming would probably be considerable. But lastly, the A&T fund, as the bill was originally written, the taxes and interest that were paid off by sale of liens would still come into the A&T fund. In fact, that initially would bring an infusion of funds into there. But the Department of Revenue has to balance that fund, and they have to set a percent each year in order to try to raise, I think it's $13 million from what we call the Tier 1. There's also a Tier 2 that was added later. Actually, the numbers on that, you know, before the A&T funding came into existence, of course, the county, just like all the other districts, earned 16% on the taxes. Well, effectively now, because the counties get more of that money back to fund their A&T process, it varies from county to county a little bit, but in our county, it's about a 40% return. So if we're to sell liens and forego that 16% interest, which we almost always receive, that's about 40% to the county. For schools, it's about 11% because they don't get all of it because they pay part of it into the A&T fund. And for cities and other special districts, it's about 7% because they have to pay into what's called the second tier. So there's a big difference there. So I could see where, although the county may not be supportive of going this route, the cities might push for it. So you might, you know, get some of that going on. I think that concludes my comments. Thank you.
Well, here's what I'd like to do. We'll have some amendments worked up. I still want to see those. I tell you, I mean, I'm sensitive to the issue of the A&T distribution and CAFA. I think that's entirely appropriate. The issues about workload and programming and process, to me, is entirely within the county. You know, if the county wants to impose this on their assessment and their tax collectors, to me, that's an issue for the county and for you to argue with your commissioners about whether you can afford it or whether you can't afford it, whether you need more staff or programming. So that I'm not personally too concerned about. I am concerned about the statewide implications of this on the distribution of the CAFA funds, and so I'd like to see those. And then I have a note here that LOC and special the League of Oregon Counties and cities, I guess, and special districts will have a comment after see the dash threes, so we'll get some chance. Well, I'm going to close the work session on this. I didn't mean this to be entirely devoted today to tax lien certificates. Appreciate everyone's passion, consideration. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3134, and I want to go to 2298. So for that, we need Butler's here, Representative Butler. Representative Smith, I think, also wanted to be notified. Okay. Sir, Representative Beller, just wanted to take care of a real simple bill before we got to yours.
I appreciate that. There was almost nothing in it. Pulling teeth and right and save little John.
All right, let me hold a work session on House Bill 2298 and welcome back Representative Butler. Mazin, do you want to bring us up to date?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to refresh your memory, House Bill 2298A, engrossed version, is an expansion of the requirements for business firms that they will be able to meet the qualifications for the small city or the city business development income tax exemption. And the it allows the business firms locating facilities in certain industrial zones. The current law as it stands with the definitions and restrictions that it holds on a qualification, it allows for about 12 cities around the state to qualify for that income tax exemption for a period of 10 years. With this expansion of the number of population from 10 to 15,000 and the different definitions of the employment and income, this will bring the total qualifying cities for to about 35. And in addition to that, there'll be a few more industrial zones that will be able to take advantage of this.
Any amendments? We don't have any amendments.
The 2298A is the...
Right.
Amended.
We don't have any amendments since we last heard the bill. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Tom Butler from House District 60. To my knowledge, 2298A, as amended previously in the Trade and Economic Development Committee in the House, is where the bill is at.
And Representative Smith, why don't you come on up? Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Smith may have some explanation that he'd like to make on behalf of the port portion of the district. We found that, if you'll recall in our earlier meetings, that the ports had certain industrial property within the counties from time to time, those counties that met the qualifications of high unemployment and low per capita wages that could qualify for expansion into the ports areas. And so Representative Smith, together with the Oregon Economic Development Department, came to us and said we'd like to go ahead and spill over and expand, potentially expand these opportunities within the ports areas within these counties, not within the city limits. And again, the reason that we had the city limits originally, and this was by a consensus amongst all of the environmental groups as well, was because we were concerned about the utilization of the infrastructure, water and sewer and other issues. We're finding that many times in all instances, the ports have all of that infrastructure, whether they're within the city limits or not, and those areas of the urban growth boundaries that have those areas that may be out immediately adjacent to but outside the city limits have those services available, and the bill expands to meet those obligations or those opportunities as well for these folks who would like to take advantage. And again, as Madison has explained, this moves from 12 small towns in rural Oregon right now. I think the most recent was that it expanded to about 35 towns, some the size of Granite, Fossil, Grass Valley, Hines, Ione, Aragon, Joseph, Lostein, Mitchell, Monument, Morrow, Paisley. These are some towns that you probably ought to go on your vacations to, but we really don't, because they do have the infrastructure, but they just don't have the jobs, and that's what we're trying to do, is bring the jobs to these places.
I think I tried to go to Granite once, but it was too early in the season and the road wasn't plowed, and I didn't get
it. Mr. Chair, when you want to go to Granite, you need to have snow tires on up until probably the 1st of June, or maybe even later sometimes. Yeah.
Well, they need to work on that for their economic development.
that's an ODOT issue, and we do appreciate all the help that they do to try and give us.
Representative Smith, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Shutterly. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith. I represent District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow County. And I must begin by telling you, Granite is the last incorporated city in Oregon to receive telephone service, and that occurred on my watch when I was their representative last session. So I'm pleased to point that out. Let me begin by saying how pleased I am with the leadership of Representative Butler and the hard work he's done on moving forward the business tax incentive law that we currently have in place and the amendments that you see before you. What drew me to this issue was the fact this is an opportunity to truly help our smallest, most rural, economically distressed communities create a couple jobs. The jobs that we're trying to attack with this amendment to the current legislation are those businesses that do not reside in Oregon, do not have operations in Oregon, but are willing to take a leap of faith and come out to our smallest communities and say, yes, we do want to locate and we do want to create good family wage jobs. And if you look at the language in this bill, good family wage jobs are the criteria. And so that's what drew me to this issue. I'd like to take a moment and address the issue regarding ports. I have the pleasure of representing both Morrow and Wallowa County, which flip back and forth depending upon the season in terms of the highest unemployment rate in the state of Oregon. In the summertime, Wallowa County's unemployment rate is darn near nothing. But then in the late fall, winter, it runs as high as 25-26%. In Morrow County, after harvest and during interim times during the value-added food processing seasons, the unemployment rate also gets into the low 20s. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to diversify both these areas who are very dependent upon natural resources and try and draw in those companies who are willing to make the investment in good family wage jobs. Well, in Morrow County, you truly have one economic development engine, and that's the Port of Morrow. And the Port of Morrow is the second largest port in terms of assets and revenues in the state of Oregon. However, where their land sits is right outside of the city of Boardman, who's a very good partner to the port. And so although this bill, or the original legislation, excuse me, was very beneficial, it was not the right tool to get the job done. I guess it'd be the analogy of having a hammer that's just a little too small. And so we needed to upgrade and get the hammer just a little bigger. And so that's why we tried to amend this to allow that to occur. I think it's very important to point out that we were very considerate of our partners, the cities and the counties. At any point in time, if a project was to be located into a city or county that this targets and they did not feel comfortable with the project, they have the opportunity to say, no, we don't feel comfortable, and to require further negotiation. And so I think there's a true safety mechanism in there to make sure that everyone's taken care of. The last thought I would point out is very realistically, if we're able to help one or two communities with this legislation, I think we can come back in 2 years and say this was a success. I don't think we're opening up a floodgate for the larger corporations to come into Granite. But with that said, the notion of creating five jobs in Granite is darn near the equivalent of creating a large corporation in Portland. So, with that said.
That, probably.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Shutterly.
All right, thank you. And we have Economic and Community Development Department in the back. They're nodding their heads that the bill works. Appreciate the work that the OECDD has put in on this as well, and congratulations, Representative Butler, for your perseverance on this, and Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Sherrilyn. I do want to express my appreciation both to Representative Smith as well as to the OECD for their help in shepherding these issues along. Because the bill is cost neutral and revenue neutral, and there is originally in the original act, there's resources for the department to actually charge any of the expenses, right, which they do have for any of these companies that might come into these small communities. I just really appreciated the way that they worked on it to help us to try and bring small communities back on and bring these jobs to rural Oregon.
Okay. Now, assuming that we are able to line up the votes to pass this out this morning, do one of you want to carry this?
I would turn to the good representative.
All right. Just want to check that. All right. Thank you very much. We're in work session. Representative Scott?
Yes, sir.
How was the freeway, by the way?
It was plugged up. Chair, I move House Bill 2298 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Scott moves House Bill 2298 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I missed the hearing on this bill, but I did listen to the tape of the hearing.
Whoa.
I'm trying to listen to all of them. I'm trying to catch
you,
up.
That's right. This was during your hiatus.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
The only comment I have is that this bill appears to me to be to establish a number of very difficult hoops for a small business arriving from out of state to jump through to accomplish any useful result in a small community. I'm quite willing to vote for the bill. I'm not optimistic that it will actually have any significant results. I hope to be wrong about that, because we do need in Oregon to figure out ways to improve the economies in the smallest of our communities and the most remote of our communities. I don't think this is the vehicle for it, but I'm willing to vote for it and hope that I'm wrong.
Well, and I think it's important. That's why it's useful to have had OECD working on the on this bill. I think there's going to be some marketing probably that has to take place with this, and I would expect that the communities that could benefit from this can be involved in that kind of marketing to try to bring that in, because I think you're right. This is not one that's necessarily going to make the front page of the National Business Journal and bring the world headquarters to rural Oregon, but with the right kind of marketing, it's very targeted, and I think that's why it's probably it looks complicated. It's very narrow and very targeted. But if the rural communities that could benefit from it want it, and OECD says they can make it work for entities and communities that want to participate and benefit from it, I'm happy to give them the tool too. Yeah. Okay. All right. Please call the roll.
Representatives Barnhart.
Aye.
Parker.
Aye.
Aye. Go on. Pay attention.
Hopkins.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2298 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Butler, you will carry. Okay, we'll close the work session on 2298. Let's where's Representative Kitts? Huh? E, do you want to bring him on down? Let's get that one. Who's staffing that one? Let's coordinate our staffing. Oh, you're all here. So who's got? Do you have 2290?
The office is here. I have 2747.
2747. I was going to do 3160.
Elizabeth.
Okay, Elizabeth, come on up. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3160. And while Representative Kitts is coming down, Elizabeth, you can tell us what this one's about. This is one that has come to us from another committee, and we've not had a chance to look at it yet.
Correct. Chair Shetterly, with House Bill 3160, it establishes a new corporate income corporate tax credit for investment in machinery and equipment that is used primarily in the wood products industry. It specifies that the credit is equal to the lesser of $100,000 or 20% of the qualified investment. It requires the taxpayer to file with Economic Community Development Department for the tax credit. It limits the total amount of the qualified investments that the Economic Community Development Department can issue per biennium to $1 million. It limits the tax credit to no more than 25% of the taxpayer's tax liability per year. It allows the tax credit to be carried forward for 7 years. It allows a non-resident tax credit under the same limitations as residents, but prorated. Does not allow a credit if the property was previously owned by the taxpayer or a person related to the taxpayer. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2003, and it takes effect 91 days after the end of the legislative session. Now, basically, with this bill, I looked at some of the wood products data, property tax data, that Department of Revenue has on the large wood products companies, and these basically are ones that have over $1 million in value that the Department of Revenue assesses. So looking at that data for 2002-03, what you find is there were 91 companies with 146 facilities, which had a total of $63 million in new investment of machinery and equipment in the wood products industry. And out of those 91 companies in the wood products industry, 19 of them had total investments in machinery and equipment, which exceeded $500,000. And the reason why I was looking at $500,000 is because that would be 20% of $500,000 would be $100,000, which would be the limit, and this credit would be allowing. So you basically have, given the 2002-03 data, that 19 companies could qualify for the maximum amount of the credit. 42 companies had investments that were greater than zero, but they were less than $500,000. So you have a lot of companies that basically could qualify for this credit. This credit, basically, if you were going to look at $500,000 per year, you're only talking about five corporations per year that would actually be able to qualify for the credit. And so the main constraint on this credit is going to be the limit of $1 million being issued by Economic Community Development Department, and this would begin 2003-05 biennium. And I will just note that in this bill it does not have a definition for what is specifically the wood product industry. I was getting a lot of questions from both revenue about what things would be included in that, and you know, issues like whether or not paper industries and stuff would be included was a question. This really is going to depend later on the Economic Community Development Department rule, which will then decide how broad or narrowly they define the corporations that are considered in the wood products industry. Okay.
Well, we've been joined by Representative Kitts. Welcome to the House Revenue Committee.
Thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Derek Kitts, State Representative for House District 30, which, by the way, has no mills that would be affected by this bill. I just wanted, the original intent behind this bill, it was a brainchild of me and a couple other members, of what we can do to stimulate the economy, what can we do to diversify the economy and provide incentives for folks to do such. The wood products industry, as we all know, over the past 30 years, it's just been absolutely decimated in the state. We've shut down mills left and right. There are infrastructures existing. I would like to provide incentives for folks to reopen those mills. Now, $100,000, and I capped it at $2 million, I believe. I don't have the bill in front of me, but I believe that was the amendment. It's not capped.
Representative Kitts, we don't have an amendment. I don't know if you have one, but
I have worked with. You should have the updated version. Is it not capped? Is it not capped in the original?
Representative Kitts, it's capped at $1 million.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's in the bill.
That's
okay,
the bill.
You should have an amendment that would cap it at $2 million. I'm sorry, I raised that. And here's why. It may sound like a lot of money in the state of the current budget crisis that we're in. However, to make one of these mills operational, notwithstanding the infrastructure and updates to the infrastructure, it's going to cost a mill owner between $8 and $15 million, depending on when the mill was shut down and at what point. So obviously, if a mill was shut down in 1983, they're going to need a lot more updating than a mill that was shut down, let's say, 1996, because they've obviously been producing longer. So that was the original intent behind the mill. $100,000 increments in relation to that doesn't sound like a lot, and it's probably not, but if we can provide some incentive for these folks to help diversify our economy and get our state back working. And I also wanted to state to the committee, I told folks time and time again, I know tax credits are tough bills this session, and I would agree with that. The Speaker has seen fit to put 3160 in her job stimulus package because she deems it a good bill. I would agree with her. And they're not tax credits if they're not used. And if they are used in this situation, I think it would go directly to job creation. So I think it would be an investment that would be well worth the committee's time to consider.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Representative Kitts? I have one, and maybe for you or listening. We passed out the on the House floor a week or so ago the property tax exemption for logging equipment. Mm-hmm. Would that potentially apply to the same equipment? So you're getting an income tax credit and a property tax exemption?
Well, Chair Shetterly, I think it really will depend on how you define wood products. It seems like, you know, some of the logging equipment may not apply, but we really don't have a definition of what wood products is. So,
did you have a notion in terms of what you had in mind for wood products?
I did, actually, and I believe that LC is working, either they've worked on that because we tightened that up, and I'm surprised that you don't have the amendments. I will follow up with LC about that.
Okay.
Yes, mine was geared specifically toward the production of timber to wood, so mills specifically, especially in light of the President's Healthy Forest Initiative, whether you think it's okay or not, if the federal government allows us to open up some of these areas to be logged, we would have such an influx of lumber, or excuse me, of timber coming into our state that was developed that we would not have the capacity to develop it here into lumber. We would end up sending it to California, Washington State, and potentially Idaho, wherever there are mills. We could not handle it, and I would hate to see those jobs. Those are family wage jobs. Go to other states.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Kitts? You've got amendments coming that address the definition of wood products?
Yes, and I will check with LC.
Okay. We'll take a look at those then. Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you.
We're in work session, but this committee has not heard the bill. Does anybody else want to be heard on this? We have the leaflet drop from the Revenue Coalition, for which we thank you. Does anybody else want to be heard on this?
Mr. Chair, I think it might be helpful to the committee if there were some people that might talk just a little bit about the wood products industry for those that might not be so involved in it as some of us on the committee to understand the
difference. He's just running out the
door.
Yeah,
he's running. He's leaving, you know, because he hears me. I was looking at him.
Your phone just went off.
But I think certainly I had Greg in mind, but I do think it would be beneficial to understand the difference in logging equipment and what happens in the process and the equipment that this bill might refer to.
Well, we're going to have some amendments, I guess, to look at. Greg, you can come up if you want to. Otherwise, you might want to wait and testify if we take a look at some amendments and we get those back. Okay, that's fine. We'll hold off on that then, and if there's no other rush to the witness table, we will close the work session on House Bill 3160. Senator Ringo's, yes, you're still here. Let's go to 2747. Is that it? That's your, yeah, come on up. Open a work session on 2747. Again, coming to us from the, this one comes from the Transportation Committee, I do believe. Dick?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. House Bill 2747 deals with income taxes, actually, but it relates to or addresses sports utility vehicles. So it's also transportation, which is why I ended up with the bill. What it does, essentially, is with respect to certain types of vehicles, it says that we disconnect from the federal definition of depreciation and the provisions in Section 179, which allow expensing of certain vehicles. And what's being addressed here is the large sports utility vehicles, which are over 6,000 pounds. And for those vehicles, they would not be allowed that depreciation on the Oregon return. And in addition, it would be added back to Oregon taxable income, so that effectively they would have no depreciation allowed on the Oregon return. Might note that this comes about as a result of the nature of the federal law, and that allows essentially expensing of these vehicles up to $25,000 in the first year, and then bonus depreciation as well through 2005, and then as seven-year property, any balance would be written off on a double declining balance. So they're getting an exceptionally or extremely large amount of the value of the vehicle as a deduction to their taxable income in the first year. The bill exempts taxpayers filing a federal Schedule F, and that's thought to not address exactly what the what was intended. And you do have an amendment with the bill which changes that to say that the bill does not apply to a vehicle that is used predominantly in the business of farming. And the bill essentially takes effect January 1, 2000.
So mostly it applies to lawyers and accountants who are driving their SUVs to work. Is that it?
You got it.
Okay, well, close the work. Senator Ringo, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Charlie Ringo, Senate District 17. Mr. Chair, my wife said if this bill doesn't pass, maybe we ought to take advantage of this loophole. I said, well, I don't know that I want to go on record saying that. But when
camera's rolling.
You just, just did. rewind.
But you you really did hit the nail on the head on what this is all about. This bill is intended to close a tax loophole that is giving people a really strong financial incentive to buy the largest SUVs. And when I say the largest, I'm talking about 6,000 pounds or bigger. And there are several bad impacts to that. One is obviously the environment. We're putting more greenhouse gases out into the air. Second of all, we're increasing our dependence on foreign oil. And that's why when I initially talked about this with Chair Shetterly, I said, well, I'm going to call this our support the troops bill. You know, so maybe we can get it some positive play that way. But third, also, it is taking money away from our state coffers and the federal coffers. Of course, we can't do anything about the feds. And when I use the term loophole, you know, I think the traditional sense of that word is that people are using a tax break in a way that was never intended. And that really does apply here because this tax break is called the light truck tax exemption or tax break, and it was originally created for farming vehicles. It was expanded somewhat in the mid-1990s, but even then SUVs were really not that popular. And so it's only been in the last several years that accountants have figured out, gee, this does apply to SUVs, and it does apply to people that are not farming. And so a lot of people are taking advantage of it in a way that was never intended. And I have this piece of paper that I hope the committee's received. It's from the Detroit News, but it shows this guy, Carl Wazinski, standing by his brand-new Ford Excursion with a big grin on his face like he just ate the canary, because I think you know, that's his attitude. The first paragraph on this, Carl Wazinski wasn't thinking about buying a new vehicle, and certainly not a big SUV. So why is there a brand-new $47,000 Ford Excursion sitting in his driveway? He was able to write off $32,000 of the purchase price as a business expense. So he was able to write off $32,000 in the first year. He's a healthcare consultant. I know attorneys who have taken advantage of this, who went shopping for an SUV and under instructions from his accountant said, make sure it's more than 6,000 pounds. If it's just a measly Ford Explorer, you can't write it off. But if you get a big one, then you can write it off aggressively. And I've heard other examples where self-employed professionals have been given the same advice by their accountants. And I just think that's wrong. And that's the purpose of this bill. This bill is to try to reduce the financial incentive to buy the very largest SUVs. Mr. Chair, there are two sets of amendments that you should have. A dash 2 and a dash 3 amendment, and I want to explain.
Actually, the dash A3s.
I believe that's all we have.
Yeah, that's all we have.
Okay. Well, there are some dash 2s that are created, and I'd like to explain the difference. I've also created this sheet of paper that says Monster SUV Tax Loophole, two options. And it explains the difference between the dash 2s and the dash 3s. essentially the dash twos would take the amount of the federal deduction and add it back on to the state return, to the state taxable income figure. And because of the difference of the tax rate, then this is all based on assumptions, but I think they're plausible assumptions, that if the federal tax rate is 32%, state tax rate is 9%, under the dash twos, the person would still have a significant financial incentive to purchase an SUV. The figure I have here is they would still receive a taxable benefit of $6,400 in the first year alone. And that's the dash two. The dash three is a more aggressive attempt to reduce the financial incentive by taking the tax write-off, multiplying it by three, and adding that back on. And as you can see from this sheet, even under the dash three amendments, they would still have a financial incentive to purchase the SUV. It just would be significantly less. And so I would leave this to the committee's discretion to consider whether it prefers the dash two or the dash three. If the goal is to try to offset the financial incentive as much as possible, then the dash three would be the way to do it. I wanted to make just a couple other points. I have talked with Don Schellenberg. I believe he has no objection to these amendments because we have specifically excluded farming vehicles. Also wanted to mention that New York has similar legislation pending that's being introduced by Governor Pataki. So this is something that other states are looking at. Incidentally, the new proposed federal tax stimulus would increase this deduction from 25,000 to 75,000. So essentially, you could even go buy a $100,000 Humvee to try to write off even more of the interest. I think this really is a win-win-win. And just one more point, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill has according to Mr. Yates's analysis, would bring in revenue to the state. But it's really tricky to know how much that is because there's not good data as to how many people in Oregon use this tax break right now. So, and Mr. Yates can provide more information about that, but it really is guesswork as to the degree of money that this would bring into the state. I know, Mr. Chair, that you are holding back all revenue-raising bills kind of to be part of an overall package that may be coming out when and if we determine we need more money. But I would submit that this really shouldn't be looked at as a revenue raiser. It happens to raise a little bit. It's really unclear how much. And I would hope that the committee passes this bill not because it raises revenue but because it's good policy.
The dash two, do you know where they are?
They're probably in my office. Okay. I can get them down here. If you'd like to see them, I can have them here in 3 minutes.
No, that's fine. I wasn't going to work them today anyway since the committee hasn't heard this.
Exactly.
This did come out of transportation with the due pass.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And it is here because of the revenue impact.
Right.
It's not the goal at all. The goal is impacting people like Carl Wazinski and some friends of mine in buying their 7,000-pound hogs.
Okay. For the record, I drive a Taurus.
Chair Chatterley, can I just address a couple of things?
Before I had a question. Let's see if...
Just a clarification. There is a farm exemption on this.
Correct.
How does it affect, say, a lumberyard owner who owns a Suburban and uses it to deliver, perhaps?
I have had a number of discussions with both Dick Gates and Dexter Johnson about possible scenarios. Contractors, for example, how would they be impacted? It's hard to make a statement that covers everybody. I think, by and large, contractors are more likely to use pickups. If somebody does have a need for an extra large vehicle, they could buy a vehicle that has four wheels in the back, and then this doesn't apply. Also, if they wanted to buy a vehicle that was just under 6,000 pounds, and they would still have their accelerated depreciation, then they would have the depreciation in a normal schedule. So,
Representative.
Thank you.
Senator,
help me understand the federal tax law. I have a couple of questions about the way that works.
Okay.
This deduction replaces the normal business deduction for these particular kinds of vehicles. Is that correct?
Well,
or would the normal business deduction still apply?
even with this bill that you've proposed?
Obviously, we can't impact the federal return, but what we would do is, let's say somebody's taxable income rate, taxable income was reduced by this amount on the feds. We would add that back on the state level, okay? And therefore, that would lessen the financial incentive.
Right.
And if you look at this chart, it shows that under the dash two and the dash threes, there's, depending on which one you want to pursue, you can do that to different degrees.
Right. Follow up with
yes. I
think I understand what the bill does. What I'm asking is a different question.
Okay.
And I didn't say it very well, clearly.
How does the federal tax?
What I'm really interested in is I understand vaguely from my old business that federal government and the state government allow deduction for business expenses and depreciation over time of business equipment. Now, does that normal rule apply to these vehicles as well as this special rule that we're talking about?
These vehicles have an additional incentive, and that is they have an accelerated depreciation. That's why they get so much depreciation in the first year. And on the back of this sheet, it kind of steps through the math in a little bit of detail where it says, here's how the SUV tax break works. Essentially, under this scenario, if the person buys a $45,000 SUV, $24,000 can be written off under Section 179 as accelerated depreciation. So they get that $24,000 immediately under the one section. They get an additional $4,200 immediately under a different section. So that's why the first year that adds up to $28,000 of a tax write-off.
Okay, and then another follow-up,
yes,
if
uh-huh.
I may.
Mm-hmm.
So this bill does not affect a situation in which a person had a reason to buy an SUV like this, used a standard straight-line depreciation, and maybe did a write-off at the beginning based on the small business annual exemption or something of that sort.
You know, I guess I might invite Mr. Yates' input. I think it's written so that it does not impact anybody who's depreciation is already in place, that they're already depreciating their vehicle.
Mr. Chair, if the vehicle is affected by the bill, i.e., if it is an SUV and it's over 6,000 pounds, there will be no depreciation allowed on the Oregon return, and any depreciation taken on the federal return would be added to Oregon taxable income. Now, keep in mind the federal government has sort of attempted to minimize depreciation on what it calls passenger cars. And the problem there is that the limit is 5,000. 5,000 pounds? I think, yeah. 6,000. Must be 6,000 pounds. I'm sorry. So any vehicles under 6,000 pounds, the depreciation is limited by what they call the luxury tax provision, luxury automobile provisions. It's now, as we move through time, these large SUVs are beginning to break that 6,000-pound limit. And so they're not controlled by the luxury tax at the federal level, and they're substantially writing them off in the first year, the first two or three years, on the federal return. And what this would do is to prevent that for those vehicles that are affected, the four-wheeled vehicles between 6,000 and 14,000 pounds. And, as I said, they would still be treated the way the federal government treats them for federal tax purposes. For Oregon, you take and disconnect on the depreciation so they don't get any depreciation, and you also add back on the Oregon return what they took as depreciation on the federal return. So they're getting a great break on the federal return. Oregon is capturing some of that break. Is that clear? No.
better than I would have said.
You wanted to say something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I was taken out of Transportation Committee. And the reason I wanted to be here is, first of all, I'm a co-sponsor with Senator Ringo.
And for the record, this is Senator.
And for the record, this is Representative Jackie Dingfelder from House District 45. And I certainly want to thank you for holding a hearing on this today. The bill was brought to you unanimously from the Transportation Committee for a couple of reasons. We felt it was a good public policy, as Senator Ringo probably already described. When this deduction was first written, it was written specifically to allow those in the agricultural sector to deduct the cost of farm vehicles. Though virtually unknown during the 1980s, as you've heard, SUVs do fall into the legal description of the exempted farm vehicles, allowing non-farming individuals to claim the same deduction. So currently the deduction has grown to a maximum of $25,000 from Congress, and now Congress is considering raising it to $75,000, as you heard. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of tax breaks, this one started out with good intentions, the original intent to help family farmers and businesses that needed the equipment to do their work, and that, we believe, should be maintained. However, with the rapidly expanding SUV market, the tax exemption has become a misguided incentive for people to buy much larger vehicles than they need. And so this has become a loophole, and as I share with my colleagues on the Transportation Committee, this is a loophole big enough to drive your Hummer through, and I do believe that we should address it. And one way is through this piece of legislation. This is a sensible concept. It's, as Senator Ringo already stated, it's a win-win because it helps the state save money, potentially over $1 million during the next during the 2003-2005 biennium, and it also is a win-win for the environment because it will help provide less of an incentive to purchase larger, less fuel-efficient vehicles. So I thank you again for your consideration, urge your support of this sensible concept, and I think Senator Ringo already mentioned that other states are considering this, and we think that this is a fair and good policy for the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions for either of his colleagues? Representative Virgil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question, but I just want to thank the Senator and Representative for bringing this bill. I think it is a big loophole, and I think it started out under the guise of doing good. And I think a lot of times when we're passing legislation, even now, that worries me about this is going to be good, but what is it going to be on down the road, and how can people misuse it? And I want to thank you. I'm very supportive of your bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dick, let me ask, I guess, just if Congress enacts a thing, if Congress increases, if I can go to $75,000, and if the disconnect bill makes its way through, that would not automatically flow through. We would still be at the previous current law limits, would we not, for Oregon purposes? So that would have a federal impact, but it wouldn't flow through to have an automatic state impact. Because I assume this would be subsumed within the definition of taxable income for federal income tax purposes. So if Congress does raise the $75,000, that doesn't change. That wouldn't affect us under the disconnect bill. Okay.
That's correct. Just as a clarification, Mr. Chair, this does more than disconnecting because it does add it back on top.
Deborah says we're not right. I'm not right. I'm wrong. It takes a brave.
but one, Mr. Chair, that you know the rest of the committee will believe ahead of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, you're only slightly mistaken, Mr.
Well put.
The Reconnect bill was amended in this committee
to provide
depreciation would continue to float.
That's right.
And the Section 179 expense of $25,000 that would move to $75,000, you would continue to float.
Okay,
with
so
that.
I'm right, except I'm wrong.
Yes,
good to know. Representative Martin.
179 is all the depreciation. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, Section 179 of the Federal Code is the special expensing provision. Okay. The other depreciation rules are in IRC Section 168.
Thank you. Okay. I finally found a way to get my question answered. That answered my question. Thank you.
We stay connected for depreciation purposes.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Okay. Let's see. There's bad karma about this bill. We've got one person in a cast walking out and another one about to come up. Matt, and we also have David Williams. David, is this a leaflet drop or did you actually want to say something? Oh, come on up then.
You got a limp.
That's good. Okay.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. Hopefully my bad luck does not bode poorly for the bill. Oregon Environmental Council is definitely in support of this bill. We see this, again, as the senator and the representative attested to, as a win-win situation. We think that the current legislation that encourages folks to buy the biggest vehicles out there that are the most polluting, when we're seeing real challenges to our air pollution problems here in Oregon and across the country, just does not make sense. And we think that this is an opportunity for us to, here in Oregon, rectify this inconsistency that we have in the tax policy and at least take away that incentive that we don't think makes sense and allow us to redirect state resources to places that do make sense. Again, we think that, you know, tax credits in and of themselves aren't necessarily a bad thing. It's just how you use them to promote policies here in the state. And so we would encourage the committee to support this bill and use this revenue that we're saving under this bill to further other things like the pollution or the pay-as-you-drive tax credit that you guys just approved this week. So with that, I'll take questions.
You just lost Representative Berger.
Mr.
Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Employees Association, and here today representing the Oregon Revenue Coalition. In one of the times when we come up and say that this is a bill that we support. We, as you know, supported federal disconnect, and this is just another step along that process. We also applaud the OEC and their efforts to try to find an offset method for funding another tax credit. As you know, that's one of our criteria, is do no further harm to the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these two gentlemen? All right. Well, we've got some amendments, obviously, that are not here, so we'll close it. I think I may have opened this as a work session, but I should have as a public hearing. How do we amend that? Rewind the tape, and we'll call it a public hearing. And whatever it was that I opened, we will now close. and go to a public hearing, speaking correctly, on House Bill 2166, and we've got another substitution coming in on that. Elizabeth comes forward, and this is another bill that comes to us from Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. Okay, with a due pass, just as the last one came. Okay, good.
Chair Shetterly and committee members, with House Bill 2166A, you have a -A3 amendment. And what this bill is doing is it's dealing with the farm worker housing, corporate excise, and personal income tax credit. And the first thing it does is it adds acquisition costs to the list of eligible costs for the credit. It adds definitions for acquisition costs, condition of I can't even read today. Condition of habitability, the contributor, the farm worker housing, farm worker housing project, owner, rehabilitation, relative, and taxpayer. Then it allows all of the farm worker housing credit to be sold instead of just 80% of the credit to be sold. It specifies that within 6 months of beginning a farm worker housing project, the owner or operator must apply to the Housing and Community Services Department for a letter of credit approval. Then it requires a contributor to also apply for a letter of credit approval. It requires the Housing and Community Services Department to notify the taxpayer when the application is approved and if the applicable portion of the credit is to be claimed by the owner or operator of the farm worker housing project and the portion that would be claimed then by any contributor. It allows a lending institution that is not subject to tax to sell or transfer the credit to a taxpayer that is subject to tax, and it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2004. Now, just so everyone's clear, basically with the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit, it was enacted in 1989. It was encouraging the construction and rehabilitation of farm worker housing. The credit is allowed against corporate excise or permanent or personal income taxes for the owners or operators of farm worker housing. The eligible costs for the tax credit right now under current law are directly related to the construction, installation, or rehabilitation of the farm worker housing. So right now you have to build something or rehabilitate something in order to have the farm worker housing eligible costs. The maximum amount that can be claimed in a given year is 20% of the total possible credit. In 2001, there were a lot of changes to this program in House Bill 3173, and in particular, it removed the sunset on the credit. It expanded the credit by increasing the amount of the credit to be 50% of the eligible cost. It extended the period for which the claiming the credit from 5 years to 10 years to allow to carry forward. House Bill 3173 also increased the annual cap on the certified eligible project from $3.3 million to $7.5 million. And it also allowed the transferring of up to 80% of the tax credit amount to project contributors. So we haven't seen yet much data, and 2002 is really the first year in which we've seen those changes from House Bill 3173 of last session. And the Housing and Community Development Department has issued its maximum amount of total eligible costs of $7.5 million in 2002. And there were 12 farm worker projects that were approved for that tax credit, and 4 out of those 12 housing projects were sold then from nonprofit housing corporations to financial institutions, and then there was one project that was sold just to another taxpayer. So basically, with this revenue impact, to begin with, you've got the issue of acquisition costs, and this basically this act would allow multiple taxpayers now to obtain an income or corporate tax credit for the same farm worker housing facility due to the addition of acquisition costs to the list of eligible costs. Now, this may not happen, for many years down the road, but there's nothing that stops one owner or operator from, buying land and putting module homes on it, having the credit for 10 years and then selling it, and then another owner coming and having it also as farm worker housing, and then those acquisition costs for that existing facility would also be considered eligible for the credit. And basically, looking at the 2002 data, what you see is since the Housing and Community Development Department has issued the maximum amount allowed of eligible costs of $7.5 million, then adding in acquisition costs to the list of eligible costs is likely to make the credit more attractive to a larger number of taxpayers, but it may not actually increase the total amount of eligible costs. What you may be seeing then are some owners or operators of farm worker projects may substitute then the cost of constructing actually new housing projects with acquisition costs of maybe like purchasing mobile homes. So having the acquisition costs as eligible costs for the tax credit in the future will likely increase the likelihood that the Department of Housing and Community Development will be meeting their maximum amount of the $7.5 million. Now, basically, with the revenue reduction that I indicated here in the table, this is looking at the issue of the credit and being able to be sold, because right now under existing law, when the credit is sold, they can only sell 80% of the eligible amount. So this is adding in that additional 20%. So given that tax year 2002 was a realistic assumption for the future, what we see would be an annual reduction then in like a 2003-05 biennium of $731,400 and in 2005-07 of $1.5 million and 2007-09 biennium of $1.6 million. Okay. And these would be costs that would be over, taken not so much in a given year. It would be over the life of, the 10-year period if they wanted to take it for 10 years or 5 years, depending on how much tax liability they had. But the point is each year you're going to be seeing then, these credits that could be transferred going up.
All right. Let's bring up, just in order here, Lynn Parton, John McCulley, and Mr. Ortiz. And I guess I would ask, have you all seen the Dash A3s? Okay. I assume the A3s are not in the bill that we've got. Is that right?
Representative Chair Shetterly, that's correct.
Okay. Ms. Parton, you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you very much, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, which administers this program, as Elizabeth indicated, for all of 1 year now, so we have lots of experience. This has already passed, as Chair Shetterly mentioned, unanimously out of House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. As you may notice, the bill also was pre-session filed, so it was vetted through the DAS process as well before that. Oregon Housing and Community Services Department delivers a number of housing-related programs and services running the gamut from homelessness to homeownership. Some of the biggest problems we face are in trying to provide safe, decent, and affordable housing to farm workers, who are some of our hardest working and most vulnerable members of society. I have already had much of my thunder stolen by Lisbeth in terms of what the bill does. I'll just touch on it very briefly. You have my written remarks. The intention of the acquired part was bought as opposed to built. We were thinking modular units as opposed to building something on site, buying something, bringing it on to site, especially on farm. The grace period of 6 months after beginning a project is consistent with other housing development resources that we have in the department. And this program in particular is unique to the department in that we have a lot of people who are not sort of the usual suspects in the housing industry who use it. In fact, the majority of the projects that we've had for 2002, 7 out of 12, are on farm, and these people are engaged in agriculture. They're not engaged in housing. So, you know, they may not be as sophisticated connoisseurs of sort of the usual range of housing programs. So we wanted to avoid the gotcha situations on that. The most important part of the bill eliminates the ceiling for the amount of credits that can be transferred. Right now, it's true that the majority of the projects are smaller than $75,000 each in credits, 7 out of 12, and those are on farm. But the vast bulk of the financial value of the credits, 5 out of 12 millions of dollars, go to the bigger community-based projects, and the majority of those are actually all of those in this case in 2002 are nonprofits who need to transfer the credits to get equity into the project. So if you've established, as the 2001 legislature did, that $7.5 million is the appropriate figure, then I certainly think that you want to maximize the value of those credits and not have them left on the table. This bill would do that. Oregon Housing and Community Services itself does not develop housing, but we work with partners all over the state who do. And as I mentioned, the agricultural industry often provides housing for its workers. It's very difficult for them to do this in many cases, and the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit can be a useful tool for on-farm rehabilitation as well as the large community-based developments that I was talking about. This program is unique in our department in that we have had projects with total project costs running from fewer than $4,000 per project to more than $4 million per project, and we just don't see that kind of range in any other program we have. Coming out of House Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs, there was also a change to the definition of taxpayer to recognize that nonprofits often are awarded these credits. They can't claim them, but they have to be able to be able to be awarded them in order to transfer them. So that was just clarifying. The -3 amendments, I didn't know if they were going to be discussed at this point, but that comes out of a series of discussions that we had with the Department of Revenue, and they are trying to do some clarifications. I can speak to those now or after people testify and come back up, or I don't know what your preference is.
Just while you're here.
Okay. Well, I'll just kind of trot through them. Actually, Lisbeth did a good job of talking about what they do. There is one clarification I would like to make. All of these other definitions are already in the statute, except for the definition of acquisition cost, which is totally new. And then the definition of contributor has been a little bit altered just to emphasize a lot of what these amendments are about is trying to sort out a previous confusion between contributor, taxpayer, owner-operator, investor, et cetera. It was unclear who was supposed to do what. We're trying to make sure that the people who have the information are the ones who are required to report it, et cetera, et cetera. So then if you look at
page 3 of the dash 3 amendments, lines 20 to 30 and continuing over to the top of page 4, line 1. That's exactly what those are aimed at. 315.164 is the section under which someone can claim the credits directly. 315.169 is the section under which an investor can claim the credits. And so it's making clear that we need to put out a letter of tax credit approval in either case. That was not really specified before. We do that already, but this really clarifies who's taking under what section. And looking at page 4, lines 5 through 12, that echoes that same effort. The portion of the credit to be claimed by the owner or operator and the portion of the credit to be claimed by the contributor. Again, it breaks out who's the investor versus who's the developer. And this is lined throughout these amendments. Again, echoed in lines 15 through 23 on page 4, exactly the same kind of thing. Elects to transfer all or a portion of the credit, owner, operator, and contributor must jointly file a statement. That's if they do it after we've already done the certification. I've never heard of a situation where somebody 5 years out transfers whatever amount of credit they have, but if they did that out in the world, we wouldn't necessarily know about it, but revenue needs to know about it, of course, because they have to have the appropriate taxpayer ID numbers against which people can claim what amount of credit. So that was added in to clarify what if that happened. The remainder of the changes, pages 5, 6, and 7, are just to reference these same sections in other portions where they are referenced in ORS.
Conforming amendments. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Parton. Let's go ahead and take the testimony from these other gentlemen, and we'll see if there are questions for the panel. Mr. Ortiz?
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning. My name, for the record, is Baltasar Ortiz. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2166. I am the founding member of a nonprofit corporation that is involved in trying to create, build affordable housing for the Hispanic community, and farm worker is one of our priorities. This bill will go a long ways towards helping us move ahead with our mission, in the sense that the housing that we're most involved with, or trying to get more involved with, is on-farm housing, which is probably the least amount of housing of this type that's out there in the state. And obviously, the people that we're targeting to try and help are the small farmer, the small grower, who is in most need of this type of housing for his workers. The ability for us to be able to help the grower and to be able to be the recipient of the tax credits and to be able to sell 100% of the tax credits versus 80% is very beneficial in the amount of equity that can be raised towards the project. So I think Ms. Barton did an excellent job in covering the whole bill, so I just wanted to let you folks know that we really would appreciate support for this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. John McCulley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit growers. These are fruit producers, apple, cherry, and pear growers, mostly in the mid-Columbia area in Jackson County and in Milton Freewater parts of the state. We are here in support of House Bill 2166. We believe this is a very important bill to continue to provide the incentive to improve the living conditions of farm workers who have their housing provided by the producers. Producers provide a significant amount of housing for farm workers. And I think it's very important that we do everything we can to make sure that that housing that is provided is of high quality. And since 1989, with the enactment of this tax credit, we've seen significant improvements in that housing. And we congratulate the legislature for their foresight in developing this incentive. The two important parts of this bill from our standpoint are the grace period that Ms. Parton talked about, this being able to begin a project and then apply for the tax credit once the project has begun. This is primarily because of the variability in income that producers have, especially in the fruit business, where a final payment on a fruit crop may not arrive until 18 months or later after the fruit has been harvested. And there are times during that period where a grower may decide to maybe extend a sewer line, put in a septic tank, but not have enough money to complete the project. Then the final check comes in from the crop that was grown, and oh yeah, I can complete that project now. But under the old rules, could not apply for this tax credit. So we see that as an important recognition of what really happens out in the country. The second part of this is the acquisition, to clarify that housing that is acquired can qualify for the tax credit. We have growers who are participating with the Snake River Correctional Facility that is building farm worker housing, transporting it from Ontario to the various growing areas and locating this housing on growers' property. We think it's important to clarify that, yes, that type of housing that's very high quality does qualify for the tax credit. We appreciate your interest in this bill and certainly encourage you to move it forward to the House floor.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Bertrand, you have one.
I do. I'm interested in the transfer of the credit, and maybe you can explain it to me. If A buys, builds the project, and has this nice time that you've added into it before they get the credit, but they get the tax credit. And then A sells to B.
Which, the
B
project or the credit?
Buys the project, and B now can use a tax credit. No.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Verger, if I understand your question, I want to make sure I do before I answer it. You're talking about selling the property and the tax credit transferring with the property?
Right.
No.
No.
No. We submit to revenue a list of taxpayer ID numbers and the amounts of the credits. It does reference, but I'm not sure that they really are concerned about the address. I mean, it certainly doesn't include a tax lot or anything like that. It's not with regard to the property. It's with regard to the taxpayer, income taxpayer ID number. So it would definitely not transfer that way.
So the acquisition, follow-up.
Yes, yeah, sure.
The acquisition is only then if I buy a project that like the Snake River Corrections project, then I would get a tax credit.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Verger, that's correct. The usual way that these are transferred, and there are examples where individual growers have sold them, but the general run of the situations are where you have a nonprofit, for instance, one of the ones that Buzz Ortiz was involved in, or Peter Hanley, who's going to speak after us, are these nonprofit housing development corporations or other forms of housing developers who cannot themselves take the credit. And so in order to get the equity into the project, they have to sell it to a bank or it could be an individual. It could be just about anybody. And that's how that's accomplished. And then we report their taxpayer ID number to revenue so that they know that they're entitled to take that tax credit.
So the financial institution?
It can be a financial institution. It has been an individual. Actually, right now there are discussions about the largest project, Les Schwab, possibly being involved. There's no reason that a corporation couldn't have this as part of their investment portfolio.
Okay. One more question. And can you tell me why, since the legislation was passed in 2001, you would have doubled the size of the credit? This is the next session.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Verger, the 2001 legislature more than doubled the credit from $3.3 million to $7.5 million, and I addressed this a little bit more in my written remarks. But out of the 99 session, there was a legislatively established Farm Worker Housing Interim Task Force, which was a very diverse group of people that did not normally see eye to eye, and they came out with 18 unanimous recommendations in a final report issued in December of 2000. And the legislature implemented implemented a number of those recommendations, including moving it from Orosha, where it used to be, over to housing, where it is now, doubling the size of the credit, extending the carryover period, as Elizabeth was talking about, taking it from the percentage of eligible cost, 30% to 50%, and then, as you indicated, more than doubling the size.
All that was done in 2001,
and so we're looking at the results of that for the first time now.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much. We have two more on this bill, and we'll wind up for the morning. Don Schellenberg and Peter Hanley.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for altering your schedule so that I could attend a hearing today.
Oh yeah.
Farm Bureau does support House 2166. Sorry. Too many things going on. agriculture has been a part of this whole process, and we've made great strides in the past few years, as has just been described to you, in improving farm labor housing. We see this bill as just another opportunity to advance that one more step, provide flexibility. I can't really add anything to the technical discussion of this, only to say that this is a good bill. It helps agriculture. Agriculture is in dire need of help, but when we talk about tax credits, this is one of the little things about agriculture. When you talk about credits, tax credits, you first have to have an income, taxable income. And so we're not always really that excited about tax credits, but this is the way this is structured, and we appreciate it very much and simply would ask your support for the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Schellenberg? All right.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon, which is a nonprofit developer of housing for farm workers, and I've handed out information which explains what we do. Primarily, I'm here today to testify on behalf of the transfer of the 20% to correct it so the whole credit can be transferred. I was a member of the task force that looked at the recommendations that were passed last legislative session, and we wanted the credit to be user-friendly for farmers and nonprofits alike, as well as housing authorities. And so this 20% idea of not being able to transfer it was to hope that people who were investing in this would hold on to a piece of the credit, and I don't think we scratched our heads long enough to figure out that that was going to cause some problems for some of these community-based projects. Every year this credit has been allocated fully. We increased it to $7.5 million because we determined that that could be absorbed by the growers for on-farm as well as for the nonprofits. The financial institutions are the primary investors in these because of Community Reinvestment Act provisions, so they're really looking for some equity investments, and for us it's easiest to market to them. We also market to larger corporations that do have tax liabilities as well. And with that, I would take any questions that you have.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Representative,
one quick question. What was the size of the task force?
Oh, boy. The size of the task force, I think, was about 11. It was chaired by Representative Mannix and co-chair Susan Castillo. There were two other reps. Senator Ferrioli was on it. There was a farm worker representative, affordable housing for farm worker representative. There was a religious representative. There was a grower representative. And there was a local planning representative. And that doesn't come to 11, but...
okay. That's fine.
Yeah. It was very diverse.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, all of you. With that, we are over time. I'm going to close the public hearing on this. Since this was the first time we had a chance to work on this, and we've lost most, not most, but some of our committee will not go into work session on this today. In fact, Lynn, if you could come up after we'll talk just real briefly. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 2166. Paul, did you want to make any agenda notes for Friday?
Just so far, Mr. Chair, we're reserving sessions for Friday on the informational meeting. And right now we have 3118, 3184, HJR 18, and 3431 we heard today.
Okay.
Is all work sessions for Friday.
Or at least potential work sessions. You said 3431, you mean
3134?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll, okay. So at least those are our potential bills for Friday. Tomorrow we should be a short meeting. We just have one bill. Okay. With that, we are adjourned.